This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com coming to you on the 10th of December 2010. And once again, I'm joined on the line by our regular monthly guest, Bob Chapman of the International Forecaster at intforecaster.com. Bob Chapman is one of the best and most incredible guests that we have on. And so it's always a pleasure to be talking with him. Bob, thank you so much for joining us once again.
Well, thank you very much. And thank you for the introduction. And it's probably only because I'm old.
Well, that did play into what I was thinking. No, of course not. All right. Well, enough kidding around. We have, unfortunately, as always, a lot of very serious news to go through. And I noticed that you begin right off the bat with the latest issue of the Forecaster, talking about the latest U.S. Economic apocalypse and the utter failure of QE1 and QE2 to affect anything other than a sideways movement in the economy. So perhaps we can start there.
Well, I think we should refer back, for starters, to Mr. Bernanke's white paper, along with Michael Boskin, another economist, back in 1988, in which they said everything that Mr. Bernanke is doing right now doesn't work. Now, knowing that he's a very intelligent man, we say to ourselves, well, why is he doing what he's doing? And I think the reason is because they don't know what else to do. This is probably, you might call it, a Keynesian dead end. And they know what happened during the 30s, and he, Mr. Bernanke, certainly is a student of that. And they realize that they just don't know where they're going. They're buying time, essentially. And in May, on this program, I predicted there would be QE2 and maybe QE3 and 4. And how far they could drag it out, I don't know. We'll only know in process and when we get there. And I said that in all likelihood, we will have $2.5 trillion each year, fiscal year, in this coming year and the following year, which would take us through the next election. And that's $5 trillion, a replication in part of $2.5 trillion in combination that was spent in QE1. Now you see behind the scenes in the taxation situation with the U.S. Congress, that is being reflected. Now I'm going to jump back to June of this past year when the Fed went into the repo market and started feeding money into that market. And they did that by purchasing treasuries and agency securities, the agency securities bonds, which are issued by Fannie, Freddie, Ginnie, and FHA. And they surreptitiously did that until about August, when others began to realize that, hey, I think something's going on here. And but at least they caught up. And so they are going to start off at $600 billion, which, of course, will become larger, and they've told you that. He told us that on 60 Minutes. And so it's open-ended. And then comes along the tax situation with the vote for continuation of what they call the Bush tax cuts. And now we have a war going on between Democrats in the House in particular. And being politicians, they want their pound of flesh. And they want this, that, and the other thing included in it. And so the package is going to end up costing about $1 trillion, all of which will go in the economy to offset the $2.5 trillion that's needed to keep the economy going sideways for 1 year. What is sideways? Growth of 1.5% to 2%. That's my estimate of that. And so in all probability, and we'll know on Monday, the Senate will put together, quote, a better bill, which will cost us more money and be in opposition to the reduction of debt and deficit spending. That'll probably be passed. I don't like it, but do we want to have a depression right now, a deflationary one? Because we have an inflationary one already. Or and let it extend out, or do we want it right now? And the Democrats have been complaining of playing a political game. And I don't think they realize that in doing what they're doing, if they don't pass the extension of the Bush tax cuts, the economy is going to go straight into a great dark pit, because the Fed can only do so much with the injection of money into the system. And so they're playing with fire. And so I have to go along with the extension, because I think that down the line, and I just wrote an article for tomorrow's Saturday edition of the International Forecaster describing what's going on in Europe. And the bottom line is this. Every nation has been doing, to some degree, the same thing. Quantitative easing, as it's called. The creation of money and credit for years. They've all been rigging their currencies for years. And they're all coming together now. And the only way to solve that problem is to have another meeting, such as the Smithsonian meetings of early 1970s, the Plaza Accord of 1985, or the Louvre Accord of 1987. Most people don't know about these, or most forget. And what they did at those meetings was the same thing, address the problems that they have at present in currencies and in economies and debt. And all the countries got to get together. They have to revalue and devalue all currencies against one another and have multilateral debt default. You might call it a jubilee or a semi-jubilee, whichever. It's the only way they're going to be able to do this, because countries can't do it unilaterally. It's too difficult, because it involves putting up currency controls, limiting travel of people out of your country, like out of Germany over to Belgium or something like that. It is very, very complicated. And I've lived in situations like that. You might compare this to Germany after the Second World War. I was there in the early 1950s, so I understand what went on. But today we don't have any Marshall Plan, because the United States has got as big a problem, if not worse, than most other countries. So that can't happen. And so the only way to approach this is to have this meeting. And about 3 or 4 weeks ago, the finance minister for Brazil said, we need another Plaza Accord. And he's right. And once they do that and stop putting things off, and come to grips, you know, no more debt over 3% of GDP, like they had with the euro. And they're going to have to deal with the breakup of the eurozone, because it's going to happen. It should have never been formed in the form that it is now in the first place. And I predicted before it ever happened back in 93, 4, 5, exactly what was going to happen. And it did happen. And so these are the directions we're heading in. That is the solution. Everybody gets together and says, let's make a deal. And the public's going to have to live with that. And it's not going to be any magical elixir. It's going to be a start. We're going to be like Germany, and everybody else will be like Germany in the late 1940s and the early 1950s when I lived there. And you're going to have to do it on your own. People are going to have to give up a lot. And you can't be rigging your currency. You've got to base currencies on gold. There's no other way. Otherwise, you're going to continue to have these manipulative devaluations in order to be more competitive. It's got to stop.
So the real question here then is, do you trust the very people, the very so-called representatives who have deliberately steered us into this current crisis to adequately represent the people in such an accord type situation.
I don't like the idea, that's for certain, and nobody knows more about it than I do. But a move has to be made in that direction. And the people who caused the problem, what we have to do is go ahead and solve the problem. Then after we solve the problem, we go back and deal with them. That's the only way we can do it. The risk for total economic and financial chaos worldwide is too great. There, you know, you have somebody who's a terrible criminal, and he's crossing a river, and three people come down, and they're drowning, and he saves them, and you're supposed to shoot him because he just murdered three people, but he just saved these three people floating down the river. So you don't shoot him while he's doing that. You wait until he takes him to shore, and then you shoot him. And that's the way it has to be. Sometimes you do things you don't want to have to do. It's just like when you're facing off against an enemy. Your enemy's enemies become your friends, whether you like it or not. Russia in the Second World War was a good example under the communists. I mean, nobody cared for the communists. They didn't like their way of government. But they dislike Adolf Hitler even more. And so Germany's enemy at the time, Russia, became America and Western Europe's friend. And so I think that's the way to handle that. You cannot always do what you'd like to do. And you improvise. It's one of the things they teach you in the Marine Corps. You improvise. You think. And you make tactical decisions. And that's what life is about.
Right. No, certainly I understand it would be naive to expect that we would be able to just transform the system with a wave of the wand. And I think that's something that people like Ron Paul often point out to, that people have been nurtured on a social security net that for so many generations now, that to take it away suddenly all in one swoop would be genocidal, really. So it has to be done, you know, through a very deliberate and long-term strategy, and I think this is another example of that, how that would have to play out over a long period of time, and unfortunately we do have to deal with the system that we have before we can transform it.
And another aspect of this is, and this is in opposition to what is being attempted by the bankers through the politicians in Europe vis-a-vis Greece and Ireland. They're giving them shock treatment. Well, when you do that, you better have people inside of a mental hospital because most people can't handle it. And it's the same with austerity measures. You don't take people down from a deficit of 22% of GDP to 3% in 1 year or zero in 2 or 3 years. You can't do that. On the other hand, revenues will fall, and so you need more taxation. But you don't take taxes from, let's say, 30% to 70% in 1 week. So what you do is you gradually bring down the problem by cutting deficit spending, and let's say it's 20%, 7% a year over 3 years. Well, then you've covered your 20%, and you're down somewhere near zero. And you do the same thing with taxation. Each year you raise it 10% to have the revenues to offset the loss of revenue that's caused by austerity. You know, at the basis to all of this, the underlying incumbent problem of the banks and fractional banking. Banks shouldn't be allowed to lend 70 times their deposit base, which they were doing. They got it down to 40% now and they're still broke. And they figure they're going to take it down over the next 50 years, which is ridiculous. And they shouldn't be forced to bring it to zero overnight either. But the point is, they shouldn't expect that the other merit members of Europe, the European Union, should come up with money to give to Ireland and Greece so that they can take that money and pay interest on bonds and pay back loans. Because the loan should have never been made in the first place. And it's not incompetence, it's greed, because they're not stupid people. Although they do make mistakes, overall, they don't. And they should be brought to account for what they're doing. And Iceland has pioneered that by saying the bondholders got to take part of the hit on this. And what the percentage is going to be, we don't know yet. And I agree with that. And the money shouldn't come from, say, Germany to Ireland. That's wrong. Why should the German taxpayer send money to Ireland to make their banks solvent, which are owned by the Queen of England? Come on, give me a break. That's wrong. So you have a meeting and you default. Everybody does. And the banks go under. And they deserve it. They were the ones that caused this monstrosity in the first place.
Exactly right. Well, I wonder if there are historical examples of places and people in I guess analogous situations in the past that we could look to as examples of ways that people can that systems can reject this type of, I guess, engineered crisis that leads to the solutions that we know that the banksters and those behind the scenes really want. And I'm thinking of times in which people have risen up and rejected the IMF and things of that nature. Are there any examples that you could think about off the top of your head?
The only thing that comes close to it was the South American countries paying back their IMF loans, which were strangling them, and which came with the loans controlled by the IMF of their economies. You see, centralization of power is not good. And that's what we have with the IMF and the World Bank and these organizations that lead towards world government. It just doesn't work. As we have discussed before, just take Europe as an example. A conglomeration of 27 countries, and if you include them all into Eastern Europe, you end up with about 35. And anthropologically and culturally, they're all different. And within each country, they're different. I mean, we all know, if we've lived in Europe, that you can live in Germany, and they have a dialect in Munich called Bayerisch, and one in Stuttgart called Schwabisch. And to the north and through the central part of the country, they speak Plattdeutsch. And then in eastern Germany, they have several smaller areas where they speak different ways of speaking German. Now here we have a country that is together, and the different types of language based upon the same basic language are spoken in a whole bunch of different areas. And why is that? It's because going back 10,000 years, they all were from different tribes. And so conceptually and culturally, sociologically, you can't band them together. It doesn't work. You can have alliances, but forcing them all to do the same thing in the same way doesn't work very well. And so anyone who thinks they can amalgamate all of Europe, some 35 nations as they stand today, is insane. It's absolutely impossible. And just look at history. I mean, you can conquer a people, but you can usually never totally subject them. But that's not what this is all about. This is all about bringing people together for a world government which will be run by a bunch of people who think they know better what's good for people than people themselves do. It's an age-old dream, and that's exactly what it is a dream.
Well, that's exactly right, and it has been attempted to be brought about in mostly through military terms in historical examples that we can think about. But now it's they're trying to shape a reality of political and economic and integrated social and scientific systems to try to bring together these communities. And as you say, we see it falling apart in front of our eyes right now. It's just a question of whether the people can really revolt against even the programming that tries to get them to obey and go along with the system. And we are seeing Europe really igniting, you know, in protest over all of the ridiculous subjugation to the banksters that's going on right now.
It abuts against freedom. All people want to do in their life is live free and handle their own problems. They don't need everybody else's. They don't need to be told that because we in the Eurozone had one interest rate that fit all, and it didn't work, and anybody with half a brain knew it wouldn't when they instituted it, and I wrote about it. They shouldn't ask the other successful nations, who obviously work harder and smarter, to support the ones that didn't. They should be allowed to go bankrupt. When I did a whole bunch of programs on radio, television, major interviews and newspapers in Greece, I told them, look, this is what you do. You default either totally or by two-thirds on the money that you owe the bankers. You get out of the Eurozone because you can't compete, and you have your own currency, and you set it low enough that your goods are very competitive. And you take a second look at the cost of doing business in your own country. This deficit's got to stop. And so over a three-year period, you have to reduce the amount of governmental overhead by 10% a year. And after 3 years, it'll be 30%. You've cut back. At the same time, you have to go to the wealthy and say, look, you got to pay taxes. If you don't, we're going to take it anyway. And if you think you're going to hide it in Switzerland, we'll go get it. And so that's the way it's got to be handled. And you can't expect other countries who have done the right thing to support these people. Because culturally, if allowed to, they'll go back and do it again. It's sociological phenomena. And I've lived in all these countries, I know. I've had homes in five different countries over there. And it's quite an experience. And you go to Paris and you speak French and you speak it like a Genevoise, and you look down their nose at you and say, je ne comprends pas. I don't understand, simply because you're a peasant. And so everybody in every country tends to be very provincial, and so you can't put them all together.
Absolutely. Well, it is. It presents a number of quandaries, I guess, for a world that is increasingly global. And I don't mean that in the sense that of world citizenship or anything along those lines. But we are living in an age of international communication and increasingly international economy. And it's a question of how do we live in such a system without the centralization of power and control that we see manifested in organizations like the WTO and the IMF and all of these other organizations that presume to rule over, completely undemocratically, by the way, rule over vast masses of people.
Well, you have two schools of thought. One is national in nature, and the other is international. And you can operate internationally by using tariffs and figuring into a tariff structure what countries are doing with their currencies or subsidization. And that's the way the system was before, and it worked okay. The only reason we've had problems like the 1930s, the Great Depression, is because of a privately owned organization known as the Federal Reserve. The Bank of England's had the same problem. It's run by people who profit by it. And they do it in a timely manner. In other words, they do it perpetually, always. And what is that? They take the economy up and they take it back down again because they have the power to do it. And so when it's going up, they're long. And when it's going down, they're short. They don't use inside information. They create it. That's why you'll have trading departments and I was in the brokerage business for 28 years and was a trader for 25 years. They have the ability to go out and do things in the market that nobody else can do, and they guarantee to profit because they're making the rules. Nobody knows the rules except them until they're ready to sell or on the question of being short to buy back. And we just saw it with the U.S. dollar starting a year ago. When I saw it, I knew what they were up to, but I didn't know exactly what they based it on. And I found out rather quickly. It took me about 3 months to figure it out. And sometimes it's very difficult to figure these things out. But you can't have systems where you have insiders reaping these gigantic profits, which they take away from the public. And you have to have a thing like the Federal Reserve as far as monetary policy is concerned. In this case, we'll use the United States government. And it has to be part of the Treasury as it was originally. And it has to have great transparency. We can't have any of this, well, we can't tell you what we're doing because it's a state secret. And Bloomberg has to go to Federal District Court, Appeals Court, and almost had to go to the Supreme Court to get the information on how the Fed lent $13.8 trillion. And the collateral that they received, most of which was garbage, and most of it was illegal under the Federal Reserve Act. On top of it, why are they giving money to General Electric or ING or seven major insurance companies in McDonald's, Toyota, Nissan? Give me a break, will you? It's a scam. And that enough alone is good reason to get rid of it and put it in the Treasury. And that's what Ron Paul and Bernie Sanders are going to try to do. We jammed the phone lines in Washington last week. They were going out of their minds. In fact, what they did, especially Boehner's office, they shut the phones down and just took messages. We had hundreds of thousands of people calling in, telling them in Congress that if you keep Ron Paul from that subcommittee chairmanship, you will begin your worst nightmare. And obviously it had an effect, although I think Mr. Baucus would have done what he was going to do anyway because he had the power to do it. But we made sure we won one.
Absolutely. Well, that is an important story. And just for listeners out there who may not know about that, just tell us, flesh that out a little bit and tell us about what's going on there.
Well, it was just last week just a week ago, every Friday I'm on with Alex Jones, and we were talking about Jesse Ventura's program being banned. It pointed out all the internment camps in the United States that have been built. And the producer said, I can't show it because we've been told not to. And obviously, the people who run the government told them not to. And we ran it up, he ran it up on Google to become the number one issue on there. But we did the same thing after discussing the Ron Paul thing. So between Alex and I, we drove him crazy in Washington. And I do think it had an effect. You can't win unless you try. And even if you get defeated, out of 100 times, 92 times, it's still worth doing it. Because you don't want to contemplate the alternative.
You know, even if you got defeated 100 times out of 100, it would still be worth doing it, because the alternative is to sit down and do nothing, and I don't think that's an acceptable alternative under any circumstances.
It's emotional death.
Exactly. And I think that's ultimately what the end game is. It's about the emotional death and getting the public to just roll over and accept their own death. And we can just never allow that to happen.
Well, it's happening at TSA, and this is what that's all about. It's psychological warfare in its boldest form on a mass populace. And the temerity of these people, it shows you how arrogant they are, how much they believe that they're going to be able to subjugate the American people or anybody who traverses the country from another place. And even though there's been an enormous uproar from the American people, they keep right on doing it. And of course, they have other goals, which I mentioned when it first started. And that goal is not only to psychologically control people, to see how far you can take it, but also I think it's for the introduction of fingerprints and eye scans to be put on cards so you don't have to go through a X-ray machine, which will kill you, or through some pervert groping you.
That's right. It's almost like a more complicated version of the boiling frog syndrome, where you have two pots and you have one that's a little bit hotter than the other, and you want to get one frog to jump into the slightly hotter pot. So what you do is you turn the heat up very high on the pot they're in, and then they'll jump out of that into the slightly formerly hotter pot, and they won't have noticed that it'll actually feel like cooling down. So again, you can create a crisis with this type of just unbelievable TSA screening, and then you can offer the solution of, oh, well, all you have to do is get a biometric ID, and all of this will be taken care of, and you can pass right through the line. And I certainly do see all of the conditioning that's going on for that right now. There was recently even an NFL ad with Super Bowl ring bearers who had a special line so they could avoid the barking dogs and people being frisked down at TSA, and all of this psychological conditioning to prepare people for exactly that type of solution. So I think you're spot on with that analysis. But on the note of fighting back and continuing to resist everything that's going on, perhaps we should give people an update about the silver bullet solution to the crashing of JP Morgan, and let us know how silver is doing these days.
Well, first of all, conceptually, it was so simple. And Max Keiser came up with the idea, let's make life miserable for them. And unfortunately, within the genre, we'll call it, some disagreed on what I would call technical points, but that's too bad because they can't see the bigger picture sometimes. What Max did was bring about a political piece of psychological warfare. We have now, and because of him, taken the fight to the enemy. The enemy is a suppressor. JP Morgan Chase, HSBC. They have, for the past 3 years, been manipulating silver. And they now have over 25 lawsuits against them, class actions. One of them is a RICO lawsuit, which I'm very happy to see, because that's what we need more of in dealing with banks and brokerage firms, the whole financial community. They don't get it. They think they walk on water or something like that. But anyway, the fight has been brought to the enemy, and it's the last thing they expected. And now everybody's buying silver and gold, too, but mostly silver right now. They're trying to force Morgan and HSBC to cover their short positions. And in that process, they will drive up the price of silver to somewhere near where it's supposed to be. And it's being very successful. And they take silver down $1.50 in one day, and they're still shorting HSBC and Morgan. And, you know, every time they do that, it turns around and goes right back up again. Because all you're doing is giving cheap silver to players who know what Morgan and HSBC are up to. And silver's going higher. It has to. And so is it going to bankrupt the two banks? I don't think so. But it's going to make it very painful. They could lose billions and billions of dollars. And, you know, we're going to get, in the end, on these lawsuits, the old canard that if you do this, you bring the bank down, and that'll bring the system down. And my answer is, just like it would have been to Paulson when he said, you either vote for it or we take the whole system down, give it your best shot. We're just as tough as you are. We're just as smart. And in the end, you're going to lose. And we know that going in. Sure, we're going to pay a price, but we're going to pay it anyway because we allowed you to be criminals. We gave you the opportunity to steal from us because we trusted you. And you abrogated that trust. You don't care about us. All you think about is wealth and power. And we're not interested in that. We're interested in living a decent life and going from one end of life to the other without any bad hitches. And so we're taking the fight to the enemy, and they're going to lose. And it will break the monopoly. And they can't go and say, well, we did it at the behest of the United States government, because the largest shareholder in the Fed Reserve is J.P. Morgan Chase. The Fed doesn't give Morgan instructions. They give instructions to the Fed. And the whole FOMC does. And so this has really turned into a very titanic event. And when all is said and done, Max will not be forgotten for coming up with such a simple idea. And my hat is off to him.
Sometimes the simplest ideas are the most beautiful, and this, I just like to stress, is an incredible idea. So what is the spot price of silver right now?
The price of silver?
Yeah.
Yesterday's close in the March contract was $28.79. No, that's the day before. Hold on a second. Yesterday, the close was $28.72, and that was the March month. Currently, silver is almost unchanged in that March contract because I'm watching the tape at CNBC, which runs above the top of it. So when it comes up again, I'll tell you. But it must be pretty close to that.
So in other words, still incredibly undervalued and only going up in the long term from here. So there's no way to lose by buying silver. And I can almost guarantee you that there are people in the listening audience right now who have never before in their life bought silver, but are thinking of doing so because of this campaign. So what would you suggest for those people?
Well, the answer is yes. There's a number of ways you can approach it, but probably the cheapest way is to buy pre-1964 90% dimes, quarters, and halves that come in bags. They call them junk bags. And you can buy them pretty close to spot. The premiums are very reasonable. And I think 95% of those bags have been melted down, so there's not a lot of them left. And I think someday they could be semi-numismatic, especially if they're in excellent condition, and some of them are, the coins, that is. And then there's silver bullion as well. And then there are other silver coins which are minted, such as the U.S. A silver eagle, etc. And then some people might put pressure by buying, in addition, silver stocks in companies that specialize in silver, such as Silver Standard or Pan American Silver or SLV, which is SLW is name escapes, a silver I can't think of it right now. But anyway, it'll probably come across the bottom of the tape here because it's traded pretty widely. So those are alternatives. But if you want to get to them, you want to take silver off the market. And the best way to do that is by buying silver. And I don't recommend the average person get into the commodity market. It's too dangerous. They're going to lose money. It's a trading market for traders, for professionals, and they should really stay out of it.
All right. Well, on that note, I guess we should let people know about the International Forecaster and all of the incredible information that you provide in there.
Well, the Forecaster is published weekly. It's about business, finance, economic, social, and political issues all over the world. We publish Wednesday and Saturday by email. Runs around 40 pages each time. We have a hard copy that goes out twice a month for those who are not on the internet. And if you'd like to get a free introductory copy, you can go to our site, theinternationalforecaster.com, theinternational, F-O-R-E-C-A-S-T-E-R.com. You can also go to www.intforecaster.com, intforecaster.com. If you want to email us with questions and we answer everyone, you just email Bob, B-O-B, at intforecaster.com. And if you'd like to call toll-free, 877-479-8178. That's 877-479-8178. And they have an offer there for a full 1 year free subscription. And the offer is fantastic, terrific. And if you were thinking of subscribing, that certainly is the best way to do it.
Absolutely, and why wouldn't people be subscribing? It's just an incredible resource, and it is so much information every week, and I guarantee people will get something out of it. And also, when Bob says that he responds to everyone, he's really not lying, because I've had quite a few listeners email me to say that they emailed you and got a response and corresponded with you about their own situation. So it's an incredible service you're providing in so many different ways, considering you've been retired for many years, so... Just a dynamo that doesn't stop, and I'm so glad that you are. So, Bob Chapman, thank you once again, as always, for this conversation, and I'm looking forward to talking with you again in the new year.
Well, thank you very much, and I'd like to thank you all for listening and wish you a Merry Christmas and a happy and prosperous new year until I speak with you again.